With Easter Day upon us, it seems appropriate to hear from one of the island's Christian leaders. Canon Philip Gillespie has recently returned to the island after a number of years teaching in Rome, at a time when the world seems as far away from love, peace and kindness as it's ever been. Perhaps it's time to hear from gentle, humble leaders who really do care about our lives and fulfilment. Canon Gillespie joins me now in the studio.
Phil, lovely to be with you, and a very happy Easter Sunday to everyone who's listening. I'm the parish priest at St. Mary of the Isle in Douglas, and also St. Anthony of Padua in Onchan. And as well as that, I have I have an interest, a particular interest with the Catholic parishes in Ramsey and Peel, and also Castletown and Port Erin. The title canon can be, for some people, a little strange. Around the bishop in a diocese, there's normally a group of advisors, and they're drawn from different parts of the diocese. We form part of the Archdiocese of Liverpool, so the bishop lives in Liverpool. And one of the voices that he much values is the voice of those who are part of the Archdiocese but live here on the Isle of Man. So the canons form what they call a chapter, and the chapter is the body that meets with the bishop.
And actually, I mean, now that you've referenced the bishop in Liverpool, obviously we have a bit of an issue going on in the Anglican Church on the Isle of Man, particularly in relation to the Keys deciding that actually, you know what, we don't want the bishop to be able to vote in Tynwald. And then there's the potential loss of the bishopric of Soder and Man. I mean, how big a deal do you think that's going to be? I mean, in terms of your dealings, do bishops in Liverpool understand that the Isle of Man is a different place, a separate place to England?
I think they do, and increasingly they do. Of course, a couple of years ago, St. Mary of the Isle in Douglas was made a co-cathedral to the Archdiocese. This happens when, especially when an Archdiocese or large diocese spans two different countries. So you can have a cathedral in Liverpool in England and a cathedral here in Douglas. The idea of the cathedral, of course, is the place where the bishop's chair of teaching is found, the cathedra. That gives us the name cathedral. And both Bishop MacMahon, who's now retired as Archbishop in Liverpool, and also Archbishop John Sherrington, who's our new Archbishop, are very keen that that link is a visible and a tangible one. So, for instance, the Archbishop will be over here in May time for the giving of the sacrament of confirmation. He'll hopefully come over at some point as well to either walk the way of the gull or come over during Keel's Week. I think more and more there's the value that this forms part of an archdiocese which is actually quite compact geographically, even when you include here on the island. But we're very varied in the parts of the world that we minister in. I've been very fortunate to be in several parishes in the archdiocese in different areas. So it's valuing the uniqueness of different parts of the archdiocese. Certainly here, it is a unique place to be, but very beautiful and lovely place to be.
And that's the I suppose, the technical side. But religion is much more than technical divisions and hierarchies and everything. I mean, what brought you into the faith?
I was immensely blessed that my family were deeply rooted in the parish in Liverpool, where I grew up, the parish of St. Matthew. And therefore, the just being around the parish and around the other parishioners and the priests there was a very natural thing to do. That's a great leap between being, you know, at home in a parish setting and valuing the parish setting and actually going forward and saying, well, actually, I'd quite like to explore the area of vocation and ministry in the life of the church. When I think back to when I was very young, there was a parish priest in Liverpool, Father Horan. It was just a gentle but very effective minister of the gospel. And I always remember something which struck me very powerfully, even at a young age. My dad was a postman driver in Liverpool itself, and they were out on dispute.
Hmm.
And so, of course, Father Horan knew full well that the amount of money coming into the household would be limited, but there was still myself and my brother living at home with mum and dad. And we never knew it was him, but I'm fairly certain it was. Just a little envelope with a £5 note would be slipped under the door.
Hmm.
It was just his way of saying, I know times are hard. There's not much I can do, but this I can do. And that always struck me as very typical of Father Horan. So I think back very fondly. He was, in those days, you know, quite an elderly man. I mean, he was coming to the end of his ministry. But that there was that very, you'd almost say a twinkle in the eye, the attentiveness to the needs of the people with whom he lived. They often say that when we're given the leadership of a parish community, we're given the care of souls. Well, of course, the care of souls is not just about the, if you like, the spiritual or the unseen relationships. It expresses itself in something very real and active. And I can look back to Father Horan's time and I can say, actually, yes, he taught a valuable lesson.
And having people like that to inspire you is really quite important, isn't it?
I think very important, because at the end of the day, you can read as much as you want. You can, and you should go into, you know, certainly when I was a student, we had to go into the philosophy and theology of it all and pass our exams and get our degrees. But at the end of the day, it's when you meet someone in whom we would say the Spirit of God is very active, they are the people who make you look at your own life and say, well, how can I take the gifts with which I've been graced and actually make a difference? Make a difference, yes, in our own life, but also through our words and actions, make a difference in the lives of others.
So the decision then to become a priest, that must have been a big decision for you to take.
It was. The way we have our formation is that, first of all, you put yourself forward to a vocations director and the bishop of a diocese, and then they will send you away to do formal training at a seminary. I was a student at the De La Salle Brothers College in Liverpool, and it must have been around the age of 17 or 18. This idea of is ordination the way in which I will find fulfillment, in that sense, I will be able to, you know, to take who I am and put it at the service of something, you know, much bigger than just who I am. It was about 17 or 18. I approached the vocations director and bishop and said, you know, I would put myself forward as a candidate if you will validate that, if you'll accept that. I always remember the day that I was called to see the Archbishop. It was Archbishop Warlock in those days. I think my dad had got an inside track on this. He knew, first of all, that I would be accepted, but he also knew where I'd be sent for training. So Dad drove me to Green Lane in Liverpool to see the Archbishop. And he said, oh, I'll wait outside for you. I went in to see the Archbishop, and he said, yes, we think it would be good to explore this sense of calling, this sense of vocation. And I was more than ready for him to have said, and we'd like you to train at the seminary in Durham, which is called Ushaw College, St Cuthbert's College, Ushaw. And he didn't. He said, I'd like you to go and train at the English College in Rome.
Gosh.
And I was sort of quite taken aback, you know, by this. I think I stuttered, oh, well, you know, thank you very much, Your Grace. You know. And the Archbishop said, well, other people will sort out travel and et cetera. You know, I'll see you at Christmas, he said, because I'm coming out to Rome then. And I went downstairs from the house, a little bit shell-shocked at the opportunity that was being given. Went to Dad in the car, opened the car door, and on the passenger seat, there was a Teach Yourself Italian book. So I just looked at him and smiled. Mm. No, it was a great opportunity. I was actually there from the age of 18 to 25. So it was 7 years formation out in Rome. Mm. Marvellous opportunity. Tough at times because all the teaching at the university was done in Italian. So you had to pick that up fairly smartish. But you relied on people who had gone before you, who would, you know, point you in the right direction and sometimes even say, well, for the first weeks, you're not going to understand all that much. This is what the content of the course is. Mm. No, it's been seven very happy years out in Italy.
And I guess meeting people from all around the world.
That was very much the feeling you had. We were in an English college. Actually, it's called an English and Welsh college. We did have students from the churches in Wales. But each nation tends to have a training college in Rome.
Hmm.
And they'll have training colleges back in their home countries. The people who they decide to send to Rome... other people who I presume they think will benefit from being in a different culture, will be able to embrace the learning that's done there, especially in a different language. But it's lovely that sometimes you'll think back to someone who say is in Australia or is in France or Spain. And you may never see them again, but you know that at a significant point in your life, you shared the journey with them.
Mm-hmm. So then, obviously, you've been in Rome for was it 7 years, you said?
I was 7 years as a student. Then I came back to the Archdiocese. And for us, you're then receiving appointments. It's not a case of applying for particular roles. You receive appointments. So I ministered in parishes in Southport, Warrington, and Liverpool itself. And then after 6 years at the Parish of Christ the King in Liverpool, I was asked to go on to the teaching staff, the formation staff of the seminary at Ushaw in Durham. Mm. So I was 8 years on the staff there, which again, fascinating, gives you a different insight. You think back to what stuck with you most when you were going through formation for ordination. And you also have that experience of being in different parishes, realising not so much what's important and what isn't, everything is important, but how to enable other people to grasp the significance of their own spiritual journey. And we're in a very privileged position of being able to do that by leading them in worship, in liturgy, so especially through word and sacrament, to enable them to grow strong in their relationships with God.
And I imagine, I mean, obviously I've never been a parish priest, but I imagine being a parish priest, you have a fair amount of mundane stuff to deal with, but you also have generally some of the most enjoyable times of people's lives and some of the saddest times of people's lives to cope with.
Mm. I remember when I was a student, there was a book that was brought out called Mission or Maintenance. And of course, what they were trying to do was make a differentiation between the mundane and the, yeah, the very significant. It always struck me as a false division, because to maintain a community in the faith, and that's not only maintaining the buildings, you've got to do that because that's the place where people gather, but what is most important is the gathering, the people who come together in to express their faith. It always struck me as a false division. To maintain, to do those everyday things that you would do in any household or in any family, is actually a sign, a deep sign of affection and care and love for that family. Yes, you're involved in significant moments. You're involved in the moments of, you know, the celebration of the sacraments. I've always been involved in some way with hospital and hospice. So there you're dealing with people who have that moment of vulnerability and fragility, which actually what you're trying to do is to say, and you're not on your own in this. Yes, there's the whole family, there's the whole society which is called to care for the individual and the family at that point. Your privilege is to bring Christ, especially through the sacraments, into that person's journey at that particular moment. That doesn't mean that someone who's in hospital is never going to come out of hospital well and whole. That's what we're praying for. But we're also saying, whatever the end of this journey, Christ is with us. Every step of the journey, and therefore the church is with us as well.
And in terms of that, I mean, have you had any particular moments where you felt the presence of God to some very significant and overwhelming state, or is this a kind of a permanent thing for you?
Oh, I wouldn't say it's permanent. Yes, St. Paul, when he was on the road to Damascus, had that sort of immediacy of almost hearing the voice of Christ speaking to him, and that transformed who he was and how he went about things. Have I ever heard that? I've come away from situations and thought, God is in this because there is the love and the care of others. God is in this because there is that sense of a peace and a contentment, which is not what I say, it's not what I do, it's what is done through the words of the church. So in that sense, yes. It's a bit like the story people might remember of the Transfiguration, where Jesus takes Peter, James and John up the mountain, and he's transfigured. There's a sort of glimpse of the future glory of the resurrection. And Peter says, it's good to be here, let's build three tents. In other words, Peter wants to fix it and have it permanently like this. Most of our life experience is not like that. We might glimpse, we might grasp briefly the fullness of the significance of what we're doing. And then we go back to the so-called mundane or the everyday, but I think always transformed in that sense. So, yes, I've glimpsed that. It's not a permanent thing, but it's something which is permanent in the sense that it transforms the way you go about things. I avoid the word change because in that sense we are who we are. I am the same person as was brought up in the household in Liverpool, with all the learnings that have gone on since then. But those things have helped me grow and develop. So I'm not a changed person than as I was growing up. I think, as with all of us, we've grown and developed, and we've got a few of the learnings of times past, a few of the wounds of times past as well. They make us who we are today. And it's very much that calling to live in the today, which is guided by the gospel, guided by vocation and calling, most of all guided by the fact that we know that we can take that love that we've been given by God and make a difference in our world today. And it's a fractured enough world to need people to give good witness.
And in terms of some of those lessons that you've learned over your time in the priesthood, what would you say are the things that you would have loved to have known when you were setting off all those years ago? What would you say are the big life lessons that you've learned?
I think once you've done all your learning and you come out as newly ordained and you go into a parish, there is always the danger, and I think this is true in all sorts of different ways of life, of thinking that we know everything, and we know not only all the answers but all the questions as well. I think as I've this year I celebrate 36 years as an ordained priest. And I look back at the different communities that I've shared in, and you've come across some very regular, very in inverted commas normal, but very inspiring characters. I think if these last 10 years before coming back to the island last year, I was in teaching again in a seminary, and again I used to say, be attentive, be open, recognize the goodness that you will encounter each and every day, and be very grateful for that and work with it. Before my time, just before I was born, the Catholic Church had a council. They called it the Second Vatican Council. And one of the great teachings of that was that the joys and sorrows, the hopes and the difficulties of the world are also the hopes and sorrows and difficulties and sensitivities of the Church. But it said, work with all people of goodwill. I think that's a very important lesson. So be attentive to the goodness that we see and be ready to work with all people of goodwill.
And actually, there's a lot to be said for most of us being attentive for the goodness around us, because the world that we currently live in, there's an awful lot of things that you would be looking at and thinking, I'm not sure there's much good to see here.
Yeah.
And again, we've just heard about the case where the social media giants have been caught or found to be wanting in relation to making addictive social media platforms. And those social media platforms are addictive because they tend to shock people and they tend to say things that are quite aggressive and anything but that kind of good and relaxed and easygoing approach to the world. Do you think, that people do need to be a little bit more appreciative of the fact that there are some really good people in the world doing really good things, and sometimes we need to focus on that rather than the negative stuff?
There's a very beautiful passage in Matthew's Gospel, which I must admit I at an early age almost learned by heart, because when you take communion to people at home, or when you're called to lead a group in prayer, it's always good to reflect not on your words but on the words that have been given to us through the Gospels. And it's when Jesus says, "Learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart." And there's always the temptation to think of gentleness as a weak characteristic. Actually, I think to be gentle, you have to be a very strong person. To be gentle, you have to be attentive to the goodness of others. But also realise that just as in your own life, there have been people there who would nurture the goodness in you, what goodness there is. So sometimes you're called to be exactly that for other people. So to be gentle and humble of heart, of course, again, people think humility is beating yourself up and saying you're no good at anything. Far from it. It's recognising the great opportunities and the great goodness that is in each one of us. And it's first of all acknowledging that it's given for a purpose. It's not just given to keep to yourself. It's actually there to be shared with others. So gentle and humble of heart, I think, two virtues that, yes, I think we could, as you say, we could all well learn from, but also try and practice each day. Not easy, because sometimes we live in a society where, the first thing to do is to see the negative. The first thing to do is to be almost defensive and to say, that's not what I think. No, it may not be what we feel or think. But to be attentive, to listen. In that sense, I was in, as I said before, I was in Rome for these last 10 years. And Pope Francis, who many people will know, died not all that long ago. He was a great man for saying that one of the greatest gifts is encounter. The spirituality of encountering others, being open to others. You may not always agree with them. You may not always have their perspective on life. But very rarely will you go away from an encounter, proper, encounter, either without being challenged or without being in some way enriched by recognising, the goodness and the desire of others to live that goodness. We do live in a world which seems to follow the loudest voice or the greatest influencer, or sometimes on social media, I need to have X number of likes or friends. And that can sometimes lead us down a real rabbit hole of just being so bothered about self that we forget about the needs of others. It would be a very fortunate and very blessed world if we all did a little bit more learning of gentleness and humility of heart.
You touched there a bit on social media, and of course the encounters that you were talking about, or that Pope Francis was talking about, those encounters happen less and less. I mean, I remember as a young fella, and yes, okay, I've got more grey hairs than I'd care to count now, but encounters were all around us. We would regularly go out to things. There were loads of events on in the parish. You met people, you talked to people. This happened very, very frequently. Certainly, if I look round now at the number of events happening in the parish that I grew up, they are substantially fewer. Mm. And most people's connection with the world is now through electronic gadgets. And it's a different, I'm going to say it's a different way of encountering it. And I'm not sure it's necessarily for the best, but presumably the church has to recognise that that's where people are now. And how do you get into that space?
Mm. Yes, I mean, I think I'm just thinking of the parish here. Yeah, we now have live streaming of all the masses and services from St Mary's. The great positive of that is that I know that there are people the other side of the world who, in that sense, encounter, you know, the parish through social media. As with most things, it's a good servant. It can be a very good servant, but it can be a very poor master. When it becomes the be-all and end-all of your life, and it always strikes me as strange that you sometimes talk about having friends. We might call them acquaintances, people who have looked at what we've written and liked it. Friendship is something much deeper than that. I think, going back to Pope Francis, certainly Pope Leo now, is saying, let's make use of these things. Let's make sure there's goodness out there, because there can sometimes be not goodness out there. It can sometimes be something that turns people in on themselves. Let's make use of what we're given. But I think to lose that personal contact and a dialogue which is not just typing things in and waiting for someone to reply, but actually seeing a person face to face, seeing the eyes, seeing the reactions. It's very difficult. You know, you can put things in capital letters and people think you're shouting at them. Mm. Or are you shouting, or are you highlighting the importance of it? When you're with a person face to face, that's true communication. And a balance is needed, as with most things. But I think back to when I was growing up, and that phrase, a good servant but a poor master.
Well, one thing that the listener won't see is that there's a very pleasant twinkle in your eye as you're talking to us here. What seems to work these days in terms of politics is strong, simple messages. I mean, the church has a strong and simple message. Why is it that, well, maybe you would disagree with it, and maybe it's just our part of the world, but why is it that it would appear, at least in the Isle of Man and British Isles, that people are less attracted to that simple, strong message?
Mm. One of the blessings of being in Rome for these last 10 years has been the ability to see the church, which is worldwide, not just in the West. And through the college where I was, you know, we had lots of bishops and seminarians and parish groups from different parts of the world. And it was really inspiring to hear how that strong and simple message, which was, yes, very deep, but not in that sense complicated. You are loved by God. You are put, you know, in your community to be a witness to that gentleness and humility of Christ. That's your vocation. And it's a vocation which doesn't take away from who you are, but actually bolsters and adds to the dignity of what you've been given. Over these last weeks in the parish, of course, we've been thinking about Lent and about the idea of how do we grow in our understanding of faith. Well, when I was growing up, they had in the primary school a thing called the Catechism. The Catechism, just a book that teaches. And it was a question and answer. And one of the questions was, why did God make you? And the simple answer was, God made me to know him, love him and serve him in this life and be happy with him forever in the next. Now, you might say, well, that's very simplistic and very bald as a statement, to know, to love, to serve. Actually, it gives you the idea of a life full of purpose, to come into relationship with God. He has loved us so much. He's given us the person of Jesus, and then to serve. Sometimes serve can be portrayed as rather menial, you know, a servant or someone serving a table or whatever. And yet, really, service means look to the good of others. I think in my mind, it ties in very nicely with that idea of gentle and humble. You know, to look to the good of others means to value the other. It means to seek to yet bring out from them the goodness which we believe lies in the heart of all people. Pope Leo, being an Augustinian, he's part of a religious order within the Catholic Church. He often quotes Augustine himself. Augustine was a bishop in Africa in the 4th and 5th century. And he says, God loves you as if there's no one else to love. And you think, well, that can't be true. But actually, I think it is true that we are all unique. We all have that potential within us to mirror the kindness and the goodness that we find in God, in the Trinity. There's a preface that we've been using at the Masses of Lent, which says that prayer, fasting and almsgiving, the three areas of life that we look at, especially during Lent, help us to imitate you in your kindness. And again, there's another word which sometimes we think is rather weak, to be kind, to be thoughtful. And yet these are the building blocks of a society which, yes, we'll have differences of opinion, we'll have to make decisions, but knows where its priorities are. And those priorities of gentleness, humility, kindness, goodness, they don't go out of fashion. They don't change from one generation to another. Perhaps we need to be more sensitive and sensitized to the value of those gifts.
A lot of people listening to this programme may well be without any sort of religious faith, but they would, I would say most people living in the Isle of Man get the idea that having a philosophy by which to live, which is about goodness and kindness and love, is a good thing. It's just that step from having that basic philosophy for life, which is a good thing, to then having to believe in some supreme being that no one seems to have found any evidence, you know, scientific evidence for in terms of existence. Do you get that? I mean, how would you respond to people who think in that sort of way?
I think that the searching, and in that sense, to use the word, the philosophy, I always think back to, there was a character we encountered when I was doing philosophy studies, and his name was Justin. Justin lived in the second century, and he went through all the different philosophies that were out and about, and he said, the reason that I see Christian faith as the true philosophy, the true searching for wisdom, is because of the person of Jesus. Now, would I claim to know everything there is about the person of Jesus? Absolutely not. I don't think any of us will, until, you know, we actually have that ultimate encounter with him. So I there's not a difference, I don't think, between, you know, the philosophy which sometimes is presented as definitely not talking about a supreme being or a God with whom we have encounter. It's about self. It's about how I want to work. It misses the we of it all, the togetherness of it all. It always strikes me, and struck me, you know, from the outset, really, that when Jesus said, how do you pray? Pray in this way. He didn't say my Father. He said our Father. So there is something. There's the whole question of believing and not belonging. There's the whole question of not wanting to be part of something which is, in that sense, institutional or institutionalized. I can well understand that. All I can say is, in my experience, what the church gives to me is a context in which I can live and know, love and serve, in that sense, and I can grow in my understanding of what it is to be called to be in relation with a God who is ultimately a God of creation, but also a God of encounter. And especially on this day, on Easter Day, you know, we think of the way in which for 2,000 years that proclamation is echoing still through the world. When they go to the tomb and they find it empty, he is no longer here, he is risen. Don't look among the dead for someone who is alive. And of course, over the Easter season, we'll read a lot in our liturgy from the Acts of the Apostles, which is almost the what happened next. What difference did this make to people? You know, how did they respond to it? How did they come to understand it? How did they continue searching for an understanding of it? But it happened together, not just as individuals. There's the idea that, you know, this day X number of people, this next day somebody else. There is the personal encounter. Philip, who the apostle, met someone on the road and just got into a coach with them and talked to them and eventually baptized them. And then Philip disappeared. He was taken somewhere else. So he walked part of the journey with somebody, but it wasn't for him to be there permanently. There was the sense of, and now you've begun the journey, God will help you continue that journey in different ways and with different people. So on Easter Day, I would say the proclamation has come down through the centuries, through the millennia. It transforms who we are, because we don't look among the dead for one who is alive. he's made a promise, I am with you always. And actually, that's what helps me each day. When there's good days and bad days, there's always days when things don't go exactly as you want them. And you have your plans, but the plan is then transformed into something, in my experience, much richer than I could ever plan myself. That's the promise of I am with you always.
One of the issues, and I hate to open this up when we've got 5 minutes left to the end of the programme, there is a president in America who is happy to use religion in terms of his cause. He is, along with the prime minister in Israel, have decided that enough is enough, and that the Muslims in Iran have overdone things and it's time that they were stopped. How does faith involve itself in all of this? Because to those who don't have faith, they look at this and say, well, this is about several religions all competing against each other and having a big fight. And yet those religions talk about love and peace.
Yes, I think on that sort of geopolitical level, you've got to be very careful that faith is about encounter with others. Faith is about a relationship with God. It's not necessarily, or hopefully never, about, you know, being so violent to others that you want your point of view to be supreme. It actually says in the New Testament, it says, why are all these battles waging against you? It's precisely because you don't have what you want. God be with the peacemakers. God be with those who are actually trying to sit people down and say, there has to be a living together, you know, which doesn't threaten the other. We've been talking a little bit over these last weeks about the Christians in the Holy Lands, and of course most of those are not at the negotiation table. They're at the well. They're at the shops, and they're living together with others who may have a different faith, may have a different vision of life, but they respect the individuality. They respect the, in that sense, the plain humanity of the other. When people get to that stage of saying that horrible phrase, collateral damage, and you're dealing about people's lives, you're dealing about the whole grouping of relationships that form families. I expect in a way it's written, you know, learn to be gentle and humble of heart. That's where the rubber hits the road. Hmm. Yeah, gentle and humble of heart. But respect the dignity and the gift, the precious gift of life of the other. It's a vast question which has gone on for millennia, you know, about who's right, who owns this, what do I need to do to defend myself and to make myself secure against others who would want to attack, who would want to kill, who would want to seize land or property or territory. A transformation of how we go about things would actually bring a blessing to many parts of the world.
Well, we've only got about 30 seconds left, so what would be your Easter message in a relatively tight few seconds?
So the Easter message would be the great gift which is given to us in the teaching and the wisdom of the gospel is something which can transform our living. Be attentive.
Well, I will say in Manx, Caist Sana Dut, Happy Easter to you.
And I will say in Italian, Buona Pasqua.
What about Scouse?
All right.
So what do you think? There's a lot to be said for a philosophy which espouses love, tolerance and a gentle approach to living our lives. So why does religion so often get misappropriated by leaders whose qualities seem opposed to that message? Is there still a place for organised religion in our part of the world? Is our generation better or worse off for abandoning the Christian faith? Time for a rethink? I'm Phil Gorn. Goramayos on Geistach Rum. Thanks for listening.